This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The city of Valparaiso has a number of projects involving neighborhoods in the community that are getting some special attention these days. They're involved in what is considered a very important grant program. And with us to talk about the program, about all the neighborhoods that are getting some assistance here in 2019, we have Maggie Clifton. She's the Director of Community Engagement for the City of Valparaiso. And Maggie, thank you for being with us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
Take a few moments. Tell us a little bit about this Neighborhood Improvement Grant Program, how it got started, and what some of the goals of the program are.
Yep. So the grant program has been around since 2018. Strengthening our neighborhoods is a big priority of Mayor Costas, and so the Redevelopment Commission was able to put some funding towards neighborhood improvement projects. So then when I started in my role, we thought it made the most sense to turn it into more of a grant program. So last year was the pilot year, and we were able to fund 8 projects. And this year in 2019, we've seen an increase in demand, and we were able to fund 14 projects that were submitted at some level, which totals at about $132,000 of grant awards coming from the city.
Go ahead.
So the main goal of the program is really to bring our neighborhoods together. So it's giving them a reason to talk to one another, come up with a shared goal, and really work together and have direct input into what those improvement projects might be. So it helps us as well as the city build a relationship with these neighborhoods and really work together on a shared project.
I know in a lot of communities there are very similar programs to this, grant programs, and a lot of them, and of course, even the federal government for that matter, the community development block grant program system is based on not only seeing neighborhoods get together, but to even help on some of the cost of some of the projects. Are you finding that's the case in some of these neighborhoods and have Valparaiso, that they'll get a match, so to speak, from their neighbors?
Yeah, so we're really lucky here with the funding coming from the Redevelopment Commission here locally. We can kind of use our own rules and guidelines for how these projects are funded. So mm-hmm. We have a little bit less restrictions than some of the federal grants. We're able to fund the projects, and oftentimes there is a match coming from the neighborhood. So we're granting about $132,000 this year, but the total impact of the projects will be nearly $180,000. So the neighborhoods are also chipping in quite a bit to make these projects happen.
That sounds very good. What types of projects are these, and just in general, and then we can go through each individual neighborhood of all of those that have gotten the support this year. But what in general kind of projects can the funding be used for?
So primarily physical improvements. So we're talking about if they want to add an enhancement to their local park, if they want to do something with sidewalks, or more infrastructure in their neighborhood. We've seen some creative landscaping ideas that have come to be and signage. But really, you know, the projects are important and they're really neat to be a part of. But we're really most excited about, you know, the increase in neighborhood communication and the increase in a sense of community in our neighborhood.
How did the City of Valparaiso get neighborhoods to individually or maybe even collectively seek the grant program and get their share of the funds that are available? Did they come in, talk to folks at City Hall, talk with the mayor, talk with you and other people in Redevelopment Department about this? So they had an idea and what City Hall basically to come up with the request for a proposal that would have to be considered?
Yeah, so it kind of a combination of those things. So the Community Engagement Department, my department, really administers the program. Mm-hmm. And so I try to do a lot of outreach to get people aware of it as I'm out connecting with neighborhoods. And then as their ideas were kind of bubbling up, we were able to pull in other departments. So if it was a sidewalk project, we pulled in the Public Works Department, and same with the parks or a stormwater project. We made sure that we were all kind of working hand in hand. That way their application was as feasible as possible when it was submitted.
That's great. Let's go through the list, and we can go through alphabetically if you choose. Kind of tell us about each individual neighborhood that's going to be getting grants for 2019.
All right. So Audubon neighborhood, they are going to get funding for sidewalk missing links in their neighborhood. Bonta neighborhood wants to work with their local elementary schools to do creative crosswalks, which is basically street art at certain intersections. Beauty Creek Villas, they're also doing sidewalk missing links. Central neighborhood will be getting sign toppers, so they'll be the second neighborhood in the city to have those, as well as a neighborhood tree planting. Sandana Point will be getting uniform residential lights. College Hill will be having a neighborhood build next year to add toddler park equipment to their existing park. Concord Woods, they are getting a pathway link that will connect them to a nearby park. Greenfield Creek is getting funding to have two little free libraries in their neighborhood. Harrison West is going kind of half and half with us on landscaping bioswales in their neighborhood, enhancing those. Jesse Pfeiffer will be doing a variety of park enhancements, which could include fencing and signage. Keystone Commons is working on enhancing their common area sidewalk area right there where they have the gazebo. Pine Creek wants a new entrance sign. Sierra, they're looking at sidewalk improvements throughout their neighborhood. And Villas at Vail Park is looking at landscaping and adding some trees to their neighborhood.
Have you discovered if some of these neighborhoods that have asked for the support with the grant program are maybe in more need of improvement? That is, maybe they're not, I would not say run down necessarily, but they're older neighborhoods, some of the original neighborhoods in the city of Valparaiso, to be sure, and they may need a little extra help, and this is why they come to you and the grant program?
Yeah, so that's a good point. Through this process of talking one-on-one with more neighborhoods, we've been able to hear from them on other things that they would like to see more attention given to. So for one example of that would be in Audubon, they really wanted street lighting out by their neighborhood entrance. So we thought, you know, that's something we do kind of outside of this grant program, come to our traffic and safety committee. And since then, we've made the recommendation that there should be street lights there. So now we're going to work on getting that done outside of this grant program. Mm-hmm. So we're able to really open that line of communication and see results, not just for their grant application, but with other needs that they might have that they think is a priority.
I was wondering if a lot of the neighborhoods, in a lot of neighborhoods, some of the folks who live there have come forth to City Hall saying, hey, we'd like to take advantage of this. We need help. As you mentioned, streetlights is a big point. And unfortunately, it's a very expensive point, too, as far as the cost of having them installed and maintaining them are concerned. But they're very well needed. It's helping, going to help in many different ways. It'll help in certainly appearance and the like. It'll help in public safety issues, kind of reduce the possibility for crimes happening. And then on top of that, too, that you want to make improvements to a neighborhood, and you can't attract investment into a neighborhood, either of people buying houses or buying buildings to make them into multi-story or multi-unit buildings without having some kind of attraction.
Right. And many of our neighborhoods might be a little bit more historic, our downtown neighborhoods, where there's not like a typical HOA or a property owners association there to take care of some of these things. So this is another opportunity for them who might not be collecting dues to still do some capital improvement projects.
Now, since this is a program that actually just got started last year in 2018 and continuing this year, what kind of input, feedback, so to speak, that have you received from not only participants in the grant program, but also just citizens in general in Valparaiso?
I think the majority of it has been very supportive of this opportunity. You know, residents having direct input into where some city dollars are going. I think that's an important feature of this program. We always do a feedback survey to applicants after each round, so I can tell you that feedback has been really positive.
Oh, good.
And a lot of them really know, you know, it's nice kind of understanding our local government more and having those lines of communication open. So it's not always so focused on the project, but it's just kind of the overall feeling of, oh, we got together with our neighbors and it was successful. We can now celebrate this win together.
Now,
I think overall the feedback is positive. We're always thinking about, you know, what will this look like next year? How can we maybe tailor it to better meet the needs of our neighborhoods and projects that they might want in the future? So it's certainly not set in stone the way it was this year. We're going to keep listening and hearing to what changes should or can be made.
That's great. Now, I know, Maggie, that obviously when you have to work with the Redevelopment Commission and give them at least the update on how the funds are going to be spent, you, of course, I'm sure I have to get the city and council involved in this and as well as the mayor's office. How do you go about in helping to be able to plan for the 2020 grant series? How do you have to go about that? You probably started on that already, I would imagine.
Yeah, so each year, I guess the way it's been going is primarily through the Redevelopment Commission. I'll present to them, you know, here are the guidelines I proposed for this year. And then once they sign off on that, I'm really the one getting in the weeds of the program. They kind of more just oversee where the funds should go. But part of that process is I'm always checking in with other city departments. The funding recommendation actually comes from a review committee made up of city staff. That are able to really weigh in more realistically on the feasibility and what things cost. So that's been really valuable. And then we make that final recommendation and the Redevelopment Commission votes on that.
Mm-hmm.
So again, we're really fortunate that the funds are coming from them rather than, you know, state or federal grants that might have more of a process to go through each round. We're able to stay really flexible and responsive this way.
Now,
but yes, we're thinking about 2020 and we want it to continue. So stay tuned for more on that. We'll see if we tweak the guidelines or the pot of funds or what we can do more creatively there.
Well, I know it's interesting that you mentioned about the fact, and you've mentioned this even at the outset of our conversation about the fact that this way of doing it locally, it helps give you this flexibility that you may not have if you had to rely strictly on state or even federal funds to help keep these programs going. And you also mentioned, too, the cooperation and the links that you have with other city departments to keep track of things. And I'm sure that probably helps in getting neighborhoods involved if they have concern, like you mentioned, street lights and other things of that nature. Let me ask you, too, on streets in particular, I know that the city of Valparaiso is always busy, as they are, it seems like every other city in the country, including here in Northwest Indiana, to keep the roads up and to make improvements where they're needed. How do things stand on some of the projects that are continuing or maybe they're wrapping up in the city of Valparaiso these days?
Yeah, so our residents know that this has definitely been a busy season for us. Our Public Works Department has paved about 10 miles of road this year, so that's a big impact, and you feel that as you're driving around town, but we're really excited about all of that. I guess probably the biggest construction project we have going on right now would be the new roundabout coming at the Sylhavian-LaPorte intersection, mm-hmm. And that remains on schedule to be substantially completed by the end of November, and we're eager to see that increase in safety for our residents and other people traveling through that intersection. We think that will be a really important feature for our community. So that's on track. I mean, we have a lot of projects going on. Our city hall, we just moved back to the downtown building, so we are open for business here. Our utilities are doing a lot of work as part of its aging infrastructure program, replacing water mains and always looking at their infrastructure to make sure that we're prepared for right now and the future with those improvements. Our parks are busy. We've got a new dog park that's going to be under construction here soon, as well as a new mountain bike trail at Creekside. So it's a busy time. We're excited for all of these enhancements coming to our community, and we hope our residents will enjoy them once they're all complete.
Well, I know that the city of Valparaiso is not the very first city, maybe in Indiana even, but probably in the Midwest, to get involved in having roundabouts replace just straight intersections to help with taking care of traffic issues and help make neighborhoods better. But it sure seems that Valparaiso they have a lot of roundabouts. And I happen to find in looking in the other media that in other communities like Carmel and West and Noblesville and Westville, Westfield, rather, in central Indiana, they seem to be sort of jumping on the roundabout bandwagon, so to speak. Are you folks sometimes asked questions from other cities? What's it like to create a roundabout? What are some of the problems that you have to deal with in trying to get these projects going? They probably turn to Valparaiso for some advice at times, don't they?
I'm sure our engineering department probably gets more calls like that than I do.
Yeah.
But I think just overall, you know, we see them as a way of increasing the safety. So, you know, there might be a couple more fender benders at those intersections, but they're much less serious and more likely to keep the driver safe than just your typical four-way intersection. So I think it's just becoming more recognized as a safer intersection.
Now, you mentioned, Maggie, that you're in the process of planning for projects in 2020. If there are neighbors in Valparaiso or neighborhood organizations that are getting together and they'd like to approach the city, if they haven't done so already, how can they do so to get on the list to be sure that they get their share of funds next year?
Yeah, I say give me a call at 462-1161 or shoot me an email at mclifton@valpo.us, and that way I can add you to my email list of neighborhood folks that I can share this information with as it's coming out. We try to keep our neighborhood contacts engaged throughout the year. That way they're always kind of thinking, you know, oh, it's about to be time where I need to bring together some of my neighbors and start talking about this and planning for this. Well, I don't think it's ever too early to start with that.
Well, Maggie, thank you for taking time to be with us today to explain the program, explain the projects that are up and getting recipient as grants recipients for 2019 and look ahead to 2020 as well. And we hope to have a chance to check back in with you here about this time next year and see how projects that have gotten into the next year are underway. Thanks for spending some time today.
Awesome. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. Maggie Clifton is the Director of Community Engagement for the City of Valparaiso. And several road projects are coming up to a close, completion in the city of Portage. And Mayor John Cannon was speaking recently to Lakeshore Public Radio, and he says that weather permitting, those projects should be just about complete by the middle of November.
We'll have Central Avenue East completely opened. We'll have Falling Timbers, which has been a long process. That'll be opened by November 1st and ready to go. And then Willow Creek Road is just beautiful. Landscaping will be going in on it. And we do have a gateway project at Chrisman Road and Route 20, which is taking place, and it should be done by November 15th.
And the city of Portage is also getting ready for having to deal with winter weather and getting the roads treated.
We just got our salt shipment, and we're ready to plow snow, knock on wood. We don't get any, but I doubt that's going to happen in Northwest Indiana. So.
That's Portage Mayor John Cannon speaking with Lakeshore Public Radio. And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. We welcome back Greenfleet Radio and your host, Carl Lissick.
Ibrahim, Planning Manager for the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission, or NERPC. Aman, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you, Carl.
Aman, remind our listeners, what is NERPC and what do you do?
As you mentioned, I'm a planning manager at NERPC, and I have been with NERPC for over 13 years.
Wow.
So far, and actually my focus area is transportation, land use, and corridor planning. And NERPC is a council of government, mm-hmm. and we also the Metropolitan Planning Organization for the three counties here, Lake, Porter, and LaPorte County.
Wonderful.
And our focus on planning that is related to transportation and transit, economic development, environment. And we are designated to receive federal funding from the Federal Highway Department to have planning for transportation and also provide funding for constructions and improve transportation improvements within the region.
I see. I understand you've been working on planning issues pertaining to e-commerce, and I know you know our listeners have heard about e-commerce, but can you tell our listeners really what that term means?
E-commerce is electronic commerce, mm-hmm. and the easy way to describe that is, you know, and we all do that, buying mm-hmm. or selling online through the internet. That's the simple way to describe e-commerce. However, e-commerce has other elements that is related to NERPC, for example, mm-hmm. you know, we have some work that is related to e-commerce, and that's why we are already conducting a study now, e-commerce in Northwest Indiana. And over the last 25 years, e-commerce has continued to increase, and it will continue to increase an indefinite way. Do you know, like, we don't know exactly, is that going to change or will continue, but the projection now saying it's keeping increasing. And one of the leading company now, we know it's Amazon, mm-hmm. which represent almost 35% of the market share of the e-commerce.
I see.
And it is expected to increase actually to 50% by the year 2021.
Sure. So as we talk about Amazon, so how does that e-commerce impact transportation and vehicle emissions here in Northwest Indiana?
Yeah, of course. As we see now, you know, some of the stores are closing.
Sure.
We have, they are expecting that in the next 6 years, we will have almost 70,000 stores, retail stores will be closed in
wow.
the U.S.
Wow.
And that's because of the e-commerce.
Mm.
And the impact of that is we have the increasing of truck traffic.
Sure.
Within the region. We have, like, we see more vans now within mm-hmm. the neighborhood and subdivisions. And, of course, it will increase the air quality, make it more bad. We will have greenhouse gas emissions mm-hmm. increasing. And as we know, or you may know, because that's your area in the air quality, that, like, The trucks makes four times, produce four times of nitrogen than cars.
I see.
And 22 times particles than cars. Yeah. And that's affected the air quality.
Yes, absolutely. So are there offsets with fewer passenger vehicles and more trucks on the roads due to e-commerce? And you know, how do we?
NERPC actually conducted a household travel survey
sure.
in 2008 mm-hmm. and another one in 2018.
Okay.
And we noticed, we looked at the shopping trips,
mm-hmm.
and we found out that it got decreased by one-third.
Wow.
So in 10 years. And that's because of e-commerce, as we see. And, of course, that like the increasing, the traffic is increasing.
Mm-hmm.
So it means we don't have car for shopping, but we have other trips. So it could be trucks, it could be vans, pickup.
Sure. So do you think we're meeting the logistics and transportation needs for e-commerce here in Northwest Indiana?
We actually, you know, like in a good position.
Uh-huh.
Indiana in general ranked number 3 for freight.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
We have a very good mm-hmm. Railroad system.
Mm-hmm.
We have the Port of Indiana in Burns Harbor, and it's actually connecting to St. Lawrence Lake Seaway, and that's make it like an international connection. And we have the Gary Chicago Airport. We have a 4 interstate system, which is really one of the significant interstate that has a good traffic between east and west.
And so what do you see as the pros and cons related to e-commerce for the future of our region's economy?
Yeah, the pros, like we have like some good pros, mm-hmm. that like the proximity to Chicago.
Sure.
We are within the 100-mile radius around Chicago, and that's one number, rank as number 5 fulfillment market.
Okay.
And that's give us some advantages. You know, when they look at warehouses and distribution centers to help e-commerce, they look at an area within the radius of big market like Chicago.
Mm.
We are also close to Indianapolis, which they have the second large hub of FedEx worldwide.
Okay.
And that's give us a good advantage. And as I mentioned, we have the Gary Chicago Airport, and mm-hmm. we have also the port of mm-hmm. Indiana.
I see.
So, and we are number 9, actually ranked in the best tax environment for
wow.
businesses.
Okay.
And that's also encourage people to have businesses here.
Yeah.
So that's the pros. For cons, do you know, I can see like it's more like a challenges.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the e-commerce, and it's not just in Northwest Indiana, we have a high vacancy rate now of businesses.
Sure.
So it's almost 13%, and actually we have out of the 13%, 9% are vacant in the last 3 years.
Wow.
Which is, we have to look to an area like that. People now used to live or would like to live near shopping area.
Absolutely.
Now, do you know, because of the e-commerce, do you know, like it doesn't matter for them to live away.
Mm-hmm.
But that's actually burden our transportation investment and funding because we have to build roads.
Right.
And we have to provide infrastructure and utilities and getting people away from the downtown area and urban area. And that's also a challenge, which we have because of that. The traffic, actually the freight is increasing.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a lot of tear and wear in our roads.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a lack of funding. So all of these challenges, you know, like it has to be improved.
Absolutely.
To be competitive in the e-commerce.
So as you talk about that, so how is NERPC improving the region's potential for a positive e-commerce outcome?
We looked at the e-commerce, you know, like when we conducted the 2050 plan
mm-hmm.
to look at the next 30 years for planning in for the 3-county area. And e-commerce came as one of the influential trends you know, like to look at. We said, you know, like we have to plan for e-commerce. We have to look at how is that going to make changes in our region. So we determine how to best maximize future road transportation dollars to support road infrastructure
mm-hmm.
For new and existing warehouses and distribution centers.
Sounds like you've been really busy.
We are.
Yes. And so how can our listeners learn more about some of these initiatives and things that you're working on or potentially be part of some of the solutions?
Yeah, but they can look at our website
mm-hmm.
at www.nerpc.org.
Mm-hmm.
Or they can contact me at eibrahim
mm-hmm.
at nerpc.org.
You know, we look forward to hearing updates on this project on further shows, and that will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. Wanted to thank our guest today, Ms. Iman Ibrahim, Planning Manager for the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission, or NERPC. Green Fleet Radio airs three times each Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities and the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission. And you can hear Green Fleet Radio every Wednesday here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Majestic Star Casino, which is owned and operated by Indianapolis-based Spectacle Entertainment, is expanding its reach into the sports gaming field these days. And we have as our next guest one of the people in charge who are helping make it possible to expand the sportsbook in Indiana with the changes by the General Assembly. Frank Ignatius is the president and the founder of USA Sports Gaming. Thank you for joining us today on the program, Frank.
Yeah, thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, for folks that are not familiar with USA Sports Gaming, tell us a little bit about the company, please.
So we're an independent sports betting company, privately owned, based in Illinois. We started the company a couple years ago in advance of the Supreme Court repealing the ban on sports betting throughout the country. So we knew that there'd be opportunities popping up. Our first thought was Illinois, and we still have possibility of working in Illinois once they get their situation resolved. But
right.
In the meantime, an opportunity presented itself in Indiana, so we are getting ready to launch the Bet Indiana brand.
Did you find that with the changes that were being reviewed by the General Assembly in their last session that led to the overall changes, including, of course, shifting things around with Majestic Star Casino and going off the lakefront and going onto land and all the other changes that the Indiana Gaming Commission had to review and, of course, the lawmakers had to approve, that this was just one way to help expand the opportunities in Northwest Indiana?
Well, definitely, and we kept an eye on all those developments. But quite frankly, our product is a mobile product, so we will not be necessarily tied to any location. Our product, in conjunction with Majestic Star, is available to every person in Indiana inside state lines. So, as a mobile and website product, you're able to access Bet Indiana from anywhere. So we're really not tied to their physical location.
Mm-hmm. I guess it is just helping be another expansion option, I suppose, that Spectacle Entertainment is taking advantage of, I suppose.
Well, it's always good to have a partner that is expanding and growing. So, yeah, we're happy about that.
I understand that you folks with USA Sports Gaming working with Spectacle Entertainment in this respect are also helping make an opportunity for folks who visit the casino right now there in Garrig on the lakefront to be able to take advantage of a chance to check out the games and in turn do the mobile sportsbook as you have it set up.
Yeah, it's in construction right now. It's going to be called the Bet Indiana Sports Betting Lounge. I think that's going to be the name of it.
Yeah.
And we're acknowledging that sports betting is definitely going to be a mobile product. So the lounge will not necessarily be a sports betting facility. You won't be able to make a cash wager there. But we're definitely going to facilitate people who want to watch the games and sort of experience mobile betting sort of under the umbrella of the casino.
Now, how do these fit in with what Spectacle Entertainment wants to do with their new Hard Rock Casino that will be built there along 8094, the Borman Expressway at Burr Street in Gary?
Yeah, I would speculate that there will be a physical sports book within that new facility, and I don't want to speak for them, but I think the idea was, since this move is on the horizon and is going to be happening so in such a short period of time, that they didn't want to invest in a big sports book on site at the old location. And they're really pointing their view towards the new location. And I would imagine that they probably have some big plans for a sports book there.
Frank, did you find that there were other examples in other states when you all got established with USA Sports Gaming there in Illinois that you were able to look at and see, well, this is going to be a good fit with us, and in turn that's in turn help you be able to allow you to expand in Indiana?
Yeah, you know, I know people from the East Coast or the West Coast don't pick up on this necessarily, and I certainly know that the Europeans don't, and most of these sports betting companies are European companies. But I do believe there's a sensibility that Midwesterners share, and I don't know what it is. I'm not saying we're better or worse than anyone else, but we share some traits, and I feel like we identify with each other. So right from our first meeting with Majestic Star, being that we're a Midwestern homegrown company, I found a lot of similarities the DNA of my company with Majestic Star. They're also a homegrown Indiana brand as well. So we hit it off almost immediately, and I think being Midwesterners had a lot to do with that.
Well, we appreciate you spending time to talk about the fact that USA Sports Gaming is doing a mobile sports book and is going to be involved joining in with the Spectacle Entertainment there at the Majestic Star Casino. And as you say, you're going to take a look to the future and see if you can expand that as well to the Hard Rock Casino when it gets built up there. Thank you for spending time with us today to talk about your business and about the expansion that Bet Indiana is going to have here in Northwest Indiana.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Frank Ignatius is the president and founder of USA Sports Gaming. As tensions continue to grow between Hoosier lawmakers and teachers over the issue of pay, educators are grappling with a new requirement that's tied to their licenses. There's a law that took effect in July that makes Indiana the first state to require career awareness training for teachers who use the most common license renewal process. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks and Jeannie Lindsay took a look together and with their report on how the state made the change and the pressure that it's putting these days on Hoosier educators.
At the South Bend Regional Airport, Samantha Brady is taking me and local high school physics teacher Dan Walsh past a high security checkpoint to complete an airfield inspection.
We'll be fine.
Past the door, we run through the rain to hop in an SUV. Once inside, Brady then turns to Walsh and asks,
"What's your guys' purpose of being here for the whole day?" Or
Walsh tells her he's here to complete an externship as part of a new requirement for his teaching license. The idea is for him to connect what he teaches in his classroom to jobs at the airport.
When a student asks me, "Well, why do I really need to understand this?" then you can relate to them.
Yeah.
In driving around the airport, Walsh has a great time. He and most teachers agree, having teachers connect classroom to careers is a good idea. But many also have a big problem with how the state is doing it.
When the law came out and told us that we had to do these externships, I thought it was a little bit haphazard.
Jeannie Lindsay has how that happened.
Indiana lawmakers have been hyper-focused on skilling up and growing the state's workforce. And this year, a bill to support workforce-related school programs also changed the rules for teachers to renew their teaching licenses. Under the new workforce-focused law, teachers have to focus a chunk of professional development training on businesses and careers in their area, like the externship Walsh is doing. But president of the Indiana State Teachers Association, Keith Gamble, says the way lawmakers changed the licensure rules limited teachers' input. And he says that widened the gap between educators and the State House.
Anytime you have something this large scale of a change to be done in what seemed or appeared to be secretively, it creates a great deal of tension.
Indiana has more than 72,000 licensed teachers. Ahead of the new law going into effect, nearly 51,000 of them had already started or finished renewing their licenses, meaning they can avoid the new career awareness rules for now. There are other ways teachers can renew their licenses, but those take more time and money. And when the law kicked in, a lot of schools weren't sure how teachers could fulfill the new requirements. Even setting the problematic rollout aside, Gamble doubts a required teacher training will actually do what the state intended, expose kids to future careers.
This solution does not get to what is really needed, and that is that connection between schools and the workforce, especially that industry that exists within their region.
He says instead, businesses should work with schools directly. Indiana Schools Chief Jennifer McCormick says this type of training should be optional for teachers too, especially in elementary grades. She says the state needs to offer funding for it, but she admits even getting enough basic funding remains an ongoing battle.
So at a time where we're not even finding the funding to appropriately support salaries of teachers, it's going to be very difficult to find monies to support externships.
Back in South Bend, Dan Walsh is now a few weeks into his school year. He says overall his experience was pretty good, because the local Chamber of Commerce organized it well and even paid for his time. But Walsh says lawmakers need to be intentional when they roll out career awareness initiatives if they want support from teachers.
I think you need to rethink this process. I think you need to go back and fund it in such a way that, you know, it's an investment in not just education, but the community.
For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Justin Hicks.
And I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
The country's newest national park isn't like many of the others. It's surrounded by some of the largest industrial companies in the world. And while Indiana Dunes' new designations drawn some national attention, so have the recent industrial spills in Lake Michigan waterways. And Rebecca Teal tells us, if the park's designation, it might pressure the industrial companies to clean up their act, so to speak.
Walking along the park's west beach, you wouldn't expect to see a lot of tourists on a weekday afternoon. But since Indiana Dunes became a national park in February, its visitor center has seen more people than it has in any of the past 8 years. But just 6 months later, excess cyanide and ammonia leaked from a nearby steel facility owned by ArcelorMittal, killing about 3,000 fish and forcing one park beach to close temporarily. After that, some tourists weren't sure the dunes were safe. That affected businesses in the area, like Spring House Inn, a small woodsy retreat at the edge of the park. Kara Howard manages the front desk.
We had a lot of cancellations on reservations, and we had a lot of people who were calling and inquiring about if everything was affected by the chemical spill here at the dunes.
Howard says the inn expects to book nearly all of its rooms on the weekends, but after the spill, it was only about half full. But it's not just tourism at risk when these spills happen. The dunes have some of the most diverse types of plants and animals in the U.S., including many vulnerable species. Now that the dunes are a national park, environmentalists say there's even more reason to protect it. Natalie Johnson is the executive director of the environmental group Save the Dunes. She says when the Port of Indiana was founded in the 1960s, it was supposed to show how you could have a sensitive ecosystem like the dunes alongside pollution-free industry.
And are we pollution-free? The answer is absolutely not.
Some say industrial companies in the Great Lakes Basin are already working hard to be good stewards of the environment. Kay Nelson is the Environmental Affairs Director for the Northwest Indiana Forum, a regional economic development organization.
The discharge permits for any and all entities surrounding all five of the Great Lakes have much more stringent standards for their municipal and industrial discharge facilities than, say, the rest of the state of Indiana that does not discharge into Lake Michigan. So those limits are already very stringent.
But environmentalists say industry isn't doing enough. According to the Environmental Protection Agency, U.S. Steel and ArcelorMittal are among the top five companies for most toxic releases in Indiana since 2007. And per square mile, Indiana has the third highest toxic releases in the country. A parks advocacy group, the National Parks Conservation Association, says industrial air pollution, along with emissions from nearby Chicago, are likely having an effect on the plants and animals at the dunes. Colin Deverell is the NPCA's Midwest Program Manager.
Visitors to national parks expect a certain experience. You expect clean air, you expect clean water, you expect natural vistas.
And Deverell says there should be consequences for companies that pollute the park. Back when Indiana Dunes was just known as a national lakeshore, U.S. Steel spilled about 300 pounds of the cancer-causing chemical hexavalent chromium into the Burns waterway, which feeds into Lake Michigan. The EPA still hasn't finalized a consent decree, which means the company has yet to pay fines for harm caused by the spill.
But what's really needed is that added layer of vigilance. Vigilance from people who come to national parks to say, we expect that clean air, we expect that clean water. So businesses, state and federal regulators, do your jobs and protect this place.
Two environmental groups say they'll sue ArcelorMittal if state and federal regulators don't hold the company accountable for its environmental violations. We could not get an interview with the Northwest Indiana industrial companies, U.S. Steel, BP, or ArcelorMittal. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. Coming up tomorrow on Thursday's Regionally Speaking, we'll bring you the conversation with Jesse Carbonda and Dr. Indra Frank with the Hoosier Environmental Council about an interesting and important merger of two other organizations here in the state. We hope you'll join us.